From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we celebrate the 100th birthday of the late Frank Sinatra, the man, the music. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. A hardened al-Qaeda fighter who served as Osama bin Laden's jack-of-all-trades before spending a decade at Guantanamo Bay made a military prosecutor's prophecy come true when he resurfaced on the field of battle in Yemen, where he was one of the terror group's top leaders. Ibrahim al-Qusi, a Sudanese native who once served as Osama bin Laden's cook, chauffeur, bookkeeper, appears in the latest video released this week by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Yep, al-Qaeda still exists. Some 3 years after he was released from the U.S. military facility at Guantanamo Bay. The 55-year-old is one of the al-Qaeda chapter's top men. Maybe should have kept him in jail. Another Minnesota man has been charged with conspiring to help the Islamic State. Abdurzak Mohammed Warsami, 20 years old, of Egan, was charged by criminal complaint with conspiracy to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. And Missouri police are investigating after at least 100 cell phones were purchased at 3 Walmarts during the past week. The FBI was contacted in at least 2 of the cases. A witness says it's not right. It just doesn't make sense. Who would want to buy all these cell phones for Christmas? Well, he's got a point. A 6-car train carrying passengers left a suburban Boston transit station without a driver and went through 4 stations without stopping. And investigators found that a safety system had been tampered with. Well, they don't have any idea who might have been playing around with that. The U.S. Senate has approved a stopgap measure to keep the federal government running until Wednesday, December 16th, while negotiations continue on a longer-term funding bill. Here we go again. It just never seems to end. But the season now, this is the quarter that retail stores really need to survive. They need a big hit. Andre Eglishon, author of Thieves in the Temple and talk show host in his own right. This is the quarter. And what are we going to have, Andre?
Well, George, I can tell you that over the last several years, going back to 2013, we've seen a decline, man, in the number of people that are running out to department stores. Yes. People are doing most of their shopping and their research online nowadays. I mean, if you go back to 2013, we had something like about 140 million people out shopping. Each one spent about $407. In 2014, that number dropped to people visiting the stores down to 133 million. By 2015, this year, we've seen thus far about 102 million people. And this is according to the National Retailers Association. And they only spent something like $299 each. Now, that's about a 25% drop in people spending money in the stores in 2 years' time. But, you know, the online sales have gone through the roof. You know, everybody's shopping using their cell phones, their smart, you know, gadgets, and yep, they're doing their research online, man, and that's where the bulk of the shopping is shifting. And it's also, you know, happening a lot earlier. People are putting off buying school clothes, school items until, you know, the holiday traffic gets going, till around Halloween. So we're seeing earlier trends. Lower gas prices is giving people more money, but they're being a lot smarter about how they're spending it.
When do you see the day where government really starts to tax online sales?
George, I don't think it's going to be too much longer. I mean, anywhere there is a revenue stream out there, and given the lust of politicians' eyes to spend money, I think that they will definitely tap into that source and use it as a revenue production stream for the U.S. government. It's going to happen. When is not known, but I think we will definitely see a drive in Congress to begin to vigorously tax online commerce.
Okay, thank you so much. Andre Eglishon, you have a great Christmas. You know, our theory about that missing Malaysian plane, MH370, was that possibly it might have been taken. It might have been taken, but here's the latest report buried in a lengthy report released last week by Australia's investigators. They have a crucial revelation. They say the aircraft might have suffered a serious technical problem triggered by a power outage, causing it to fly and fly and fly for hours while the pilots desperately tried to get the power back on the plane until it ran out of fuel. That's their possible explanation there. Being miserable or stressed out will not increase your risk of dying, according to a report in the United Kingdom. It had been thought that being unhappy was bad for health, particularly the heart, but a decade-long analysis published in The Lancet said previous studies had just confused the cause and that being stressed will not cause you to die early. A settlement has been reached in a lawsuit over whether Happy Birthday to You, one of the best-known and beloved songs in the world, is owned by a music publisher who earned millions of dollars by enforcing its copyright. U.S. District Judge George King has ruled that Warner Chappell Music didn't own the lyrics to the song, only some of the musical arrangements, and thus the company had no right to charge for its use. A trial was going to begin in Los Angeles, but all the parties involved have settled the licensing fees, which are estimated at about $2 million a year. So if you have a party and you sing the song, you don't have to worry about somebody tapping on your door to collect some money. In Canada, of course, they're talking about the constellation Gemini, and of course that means the annual Geminid meteor shower is underway. So let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Another meteor shower. They just keep coming.
Yes, George, and actually this one might be considered the year's best. Back in August, we had our friends here in Arizona with Meteor Madness for Perseids, but here it is. If sky watchers look into the northeast part of the sky, doing now as we're listening live and talking live, Sunday night, George, this is where the peak of the shower takes place. What it is debris from a very strange object, because most meteor showers, as we all know, are caused by icy comets. But in this particular case, astronomers believe that this all comes from a rock comet, meaning slash asteroid, called 3200 Phaethon. And what that means is there's probably larger debris fields from this object that's been discovered, that is, back around 1983. So to sum it up, take a look into the northeast sky. You'll see the constellation Gemini, the twins. The two bright stars are Castor and Pollux. The radiant, George, is right where the bright star Castor is, but you don't have to stare at that area. Get a load of this. Hourly rates for this meteor shower, if you have clear skies, should be well up to 120 per hour, which makes it, George, probably the best meteor shower of all of 2015, something that the Coast listeners, I'm sure, will not miss. And I'm going to go out and take a look just after this, as I'm sure many will. George, I want to wish everybody the best for a happy holidays, a Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. And we'll count you down on the Geminids, a great shower to talk about.
You got it. Thanks, Stephen. Appreciate it. An early morning missile test in New Mexico left a white contrail that quickly turned into a corkscrew visible for hundreds of miles. Lots of people were sending me emails saying, oh my God, what is it? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, did you get many reports on that?
Well, you've just solved a mystery for me, George. I'm indebted to you yet again. I didn't know what that thing was, and I didn't have time today to try to track it down.
There you go.
Boy, lots going on, and you probably have heard the scuttlebutt now. I'm 2 weeks from tonight. I'm going to be up in none other than North Pole, Alaska, and I'm going to be monitoring Santa's workshop. So if any of the Coast listeners have youngsters in residence, and of course that's by my measure 90 years of age or younger, anything over that is pushing middle age by my measure. We might do a broadcast from up there, and you know my propensity for tracking things.
I love it. Well, let's try to get you on Christmas Eve, can you?
Yeah, that's what I'm shooting for.
All right.
I'm looking forward to it if you need some filler. But lots going on. Coast listeners may recall last week I did some, stories of very dramatic sightings that occurred last Friday night, the 4th of December. Well, we have finally posted those reports. I think there are about 20 to 26 reports posted for that evening. And if people want to really know what's going on as opposed to paying attention to what the government's trying to make them believe is going on, they might enjoy reading some of those really, really interesting reports. One of them you probably recall was from Victoria. I'm going to start tonight with a very similar report from none other than Cuba. Four adults from Ontario were down on the north shore of Cuba, the island of Cuba, and they saw something very similar 2 days earlier, an orange light streaking overhead, very bright, very distinctly orange, suddenly came back, headed the other direction, very similar to what was reported from Victoria last Friday night, the 4th of December. A report from Ottawa, Ottawa, Canada, out west of, well, the capital city of Canada, of course, a gentleman, two adults were driving on Route 416, driving to the north, saw a cluster of three red objects. At first they thought they were separate objects, then they realized that it was probably one solid triangular craft.
One big one.
I mention it only because it's close to the capital city of Canada. I should send these reports from Canada on to Paul Hellyer. I suspect he would be interested.
Sure would.
2 days ago, 3 days ago, the 7th of December, Pearl Harbor Day, Oklahoma now, the Kerr Reservoir out east of Oklahoma City. Gentleman was out hiking, got on top of the local mountain, Short Mountain, right on the edge of the Kerr Reservoir. He lay down for a little while, about 4 o'clock. He's staring up in the sky, watching buzzards fly over him. Probably not a good policy. And his attention was suddenly drawn to a cluster of 8 to 11, he estimated, tiny white disks that were streaking all over the sky above him. Very interesting report. Another report 2 days later from Walpole Island, Canada. That's northeast of Detroit. Gentleman and his sister saw a huge triangle go right over their vehicle, they report. Very nicely written report. I suspect it's probably quite credible. It said it had a yellow light on it, and it was headed towards Selfridge Air Force Base or airport. Very good report, and we'll have that posted in the very near future. Finally, two reports tonight, one from Madison, Wisconsin, about a green disc that was seen streaking overhead, and within minutes, a report from St. Paul, Minnesota, of flashing green lightning above solid clouds. So, as always, there's a lot going on, and we'll keep you up to date on what takes place in the future, George.
You got it. Thanks, Peter. We'll talk to you on Christmas Eve, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you next week as well. Well, as you know, it's the 100th anniversary of the birth of Frank Sinatra. We'll be talking about him later on tonight. But did you also know this is the 90th anniversary of Rod Serling from The Twilight Zone? Mark Zickrey will be joining us next to talk about that and other incredible Hollywood things on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Mark Zickrey is a science fiction author, television writer, a dear friend of ours, a screenwriter. He has written for many major studios and networks. He has been nominated for several of the industry's big awards. He started writing as a little boy and wrote his first book at the age of 22 when he was a young adult. Mark mentors individuals in the entertainment industry. He is a producer, director of Space Command, and of course, the book, The Twilight Zone Companion. He's written a couple others too, Magic Time and so many others, but he's one of our favorites, one of our friends, and here he is, Mark Zickrey on Coast to Coast. Always a pleasure, Mark.
It's great to be here, George. It's always great to talk to you.
And what a great time of year, isn't
yeah.
it? So we're talking about Sinatra later tonight. We're pushing this 100th anniversary. And lo and behold, Rod Serling, 90 years.
Yeah, amazing. And, well, you know, he enjoyed his success very early on. In his early 30s, he was doing The Twilight Zone, and he actually never intended to be a science fiction writer. He actually wanted to be a mainstream dramatist, but even though he was enormously successful in television and won a lot of Emmys, he was always censored. This was during the 1950s, so anytime he wanted to write about race or social issues or politics, he'd be censored, and he was very frustrated. So he turned to science fiction as a way of kind of getting his message past the censors, and he created Twilight Zone, and it ran for 5 seasons, and he had pretty much total control over that show. He was just phenomenal. He was one of a kind.
He never thought he was a success.
No. No, and that's amazing. And, you know, I'm writing the new edition of The Twilight Zone Companion, and I write about that because if I speculate on what Rod would think if he were here now, if I was sitting across the table from him and he was 90 years old. Basically, he created the new golden age of TV. All these showrunners, all these people creating shows like Breaking Bad and Lost and you name it, Mad Men, they all idolized Rod Serling. They looked to him as their model. And so Rod was the great writer of the first golden age of TV, but he was actually responsible for the second golden age as well. And I think now he would understand that he had done something phenomenal. Twilight Zone is still as popular as it ever was. And also there's this complete new generation of TV. And if Rod were coming up now, he would be able to write about all those issues he wanted to write about directly. He wouldn't be censored. But it's a shame that when he died, he was only 50 years old when he died in 1975, and he thought he had failed. He in his last interview, someone said, "Well, do you think your career has been a success?" And he said, "Well, good writing, like fine wine, has to age well." He said, "My stuff was momentarily adequate."
He was a heavy smoker. I used to remember him as a kid coming on the Twilight Zone set smoking, right?
Yes. Well, I actually have a Rod Serling model kit, and he's holding a cigarette in the model kit. So that's how prevalent that was. And he died of complications from open-heart surgery. So the mixture of smoking and genetics and a lot of factors led to his premature death.
Would they have been able to save him with today's medicine, Mark?
Yes, I think so. I think so. And, it's a very different medical landscape now than back in 75.
We wrote an editorial, and you remember this because you were instrumental in getting Ray Bradbury to look at it and read it, and he sent me a very incredible congratulatory letter. But we wrote an editorial in our After Dark newsletter about his I Sing the Body Electric, which was a Twilight Zone episode and a great one, and Bradbury just loved the editorial we wrote. But did he know Rod well? Did they get along?
Yes. Well, you know, it's a fascinating story because when I first started writing The Twilight Zone Companion in my early 20s, you know, I was up in Rod Serling's attic. I started writing the book just 2 years after Serling died, and I was up in Rod's attic, and I found a box that was unmarked, and I opened it, and it was full of Twilight Zone scripts that had never been made.
Oh, wow.
And there were two by Ray Bradbury, and one of them had a handwritten letter on the title page saying, "Here's the first of what will be many scripts I want to write for Twilight Zone. Looking forward to a long and fruitful relationship. You know, best of wishes, your friend Ray Bradbury." And yet Ray only wrote that one episode of Twilight Zone in the third season. And I thought, well, clearly there's a mystery here, particularly because Ray's three proteges, Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson, and George Clayton Johnson, became the major writers of Twilight Zone behind Ray, Rod Serling. And so, but when I reached out to Ray Bradbury to interview him when I was researching the book, he declined. He wrote me a letter very gracefully declining. But then years later, many years later, decades, he and I became very close friends, and I knew he and Rod had a falling out, so I was even reticent to bring up the fact that I had written The Twilight Zone Companion. But as our friendship deepened, and I felt very safe in bringing it up, I told him I'd written the book, and I said, "Now tell me what happened between you and Rod." And initially, when, as I said, Rod Serling never intended to be a science fiction writer. When Twilight Zone got picked up after he did the pilot, when it got picked up the series, he immediately called Ray Bradbury and said, "You know, help, I need to be educated about science fiction." And Ray said, "Come on over to the house." And he took him down to the basement where his office was, and he pulled four books out of his bookshelf. One was by Ray, one was by Richard Matheson, one of his proteges, one of them was by Charles Beaumont, one of his proteges, and the fourth one was by John Collier, who was a British short story writer. And Rod read them and immediately hired Ray Bradbury, Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson to write episodes.
I love
and
it.
He optioned a story by John Collier that was then adapted as a Twilight Zone episode. But there were various things that led to their falling out. And then in the new edition of The Twilight Zone Companion, the e-book that's coming out, I write about that. And I also, in fact, recorded, I have my own YouTube channel now called Mr. Sci-Fi, and I actually recorded a 30-minute video telling the entire story that Ray Bradbury told me all those years later. And it's an amazing story. And, you know, because he and Rod were both geniuses, but but sadly they didn't have
a little friction.
Yeah, there was a little friction, absolutely.
Hey, Mark, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back and talk more about the Twilight Zone and your movies, Space Command, which you're making Hollywood wake up because you're doing it on a purse string. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Mark Zickrey on Coast to Coast AM. If you want to take a look at the trailer of Space Command, Mark's movie, it's linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. We'll talk about that in a moment. How many young people now, Mark, just have lost the opportunity to learn this incredible amount of knowledge that Rod Serling gave us every week?
Well, you know, the thing that's wonderful is, you know, if we were, you know, growing up in any centuries but the 20th and 21st, we wouldn't be able to see the work that these people had done, you know, 50 years earlier, 60 years earlier. It would be, you know, we'd hear about great theatrical presentations, but we'd just be able to hear about them like Edwin Booth on stage doing Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But because Rod worked in a filmed medium, we can see exactly what he came up with in 1959, 1960, etc., and we can share it. So he's still imparting wisdom to all of us. The thing that's wonderful is that Twilight Zone still speaks to younger generations. It doesn't, it's, you know, how many shows from 1959 are still valid, are still, Twilight Zone has every bit the punch, you know, the punch and the power that it ever had.
Thank God for DVDs these days.
Yeah.
My God, it just lives and goes on and on and on forever. A couple little more things with Twilight Zone, then I want to get into Space Command with you, which is an incredible project. And I'm glad that you have been able to announce that over the years on our program, because that is just magnificent. Your trailer, I don't know how you did it, especially with the budget you were working with. I mean, unbelievable.
I know. It's amazing, and I'm very, very proud of it and very pleased. And just wait till you see the entire movie. Where, our goal is to sell Space Command as a series, but I went directly to the audience, and I trust the audience much more than the executives, and they really came through for me. And so I have my own studio full of spaceship sets, and we're doing this great, sprawling, wonderful story. It's three families over 150 years in the future as we go out into space, colonize the solar system, jump to the stars. But it's a hopeful vision of the future. It's not dark and nihilistic. I think it's very important to impart a hopeful vision, just like Star Trek did and Star Wars does.
Can you pitch it as a TV series?
Yes. Well, basically, what I've been doing is, it's all about creating evidence, and I strongly believe in creating the thing itself. And so now that we've shot the first 2 hour story, we're in post production on that, and we just shot 1/3 of the second 2 hour story just in the last couple of weeks. And so we have a lot of the story laid out. And I've written, you know, as you know, I've written about the first 8 of 12 hours. I've laid out the 12 hours of the entire first season. And so now we're getting ready to start having the meetings with the big networks and internet platforms, but it'll be on our terms, which is great. It'll be someone who's collaborative with us and won't be imposing a vision that's going to wreck it. So that's why I went this route, rather than going directly to the networks when it was just an idea. Many of my friends run network shows, and they said, well, we can walk it in with you, but I didn't want to sell it when it was just a notion. I wanted to actually shoot it. I wanted to team up with a lot of the actors that I love, Doug Jones, my friend from Falling Skies and The Strain, Mike Harney, who's on Orange is the New Black, and I just got to work with one of my heroes. There's an actor named James Hong who's in Blade Runner, and he's the villain in Big Trouble in Little China. He's 86, and I've been wanting to work with him forever, and he was just in Space Command, so it was a thrill.
And you got the Twilight Zone's Lost in Space Billy Mumy, too.
Yes,
didn't
I did.
You?
Well, I've known Bill Mumy since I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
And we worked together on Babylon 5, and he was a thrill to work with on Space Command.
You approached Bill when he was a youngster.
Yes.
How did that? Give us that story. It's an amazing story.
Well, you know, the way I am now is pretty much the way I was as a kid, and so I'm pretty bold. And so when Lost in Space was on the air, I was a fan of that show. And one day I was homesick with a cold. I was about 7 years old, and I was home on my own because it was the 60s and parents did that.
Yeah.
And I got this idea that I would look up the stars of Lost in Space in the phone book and call them. So I started calling people, and most of them were just people with the same names, but they weren't those actors. But there was one Mumy in the phone book, and it must have been Bill's dad, because I called it, and his mom answered, and I said, is Bill there? Is Billy there? And she said, hold on. And Billy came to the phone, and at first I was so nervous, all I could do was blurt out, will you be my friend, and hang up. But then I called him back, and as soon as I was over the cold, my mom drove me to his house, and we traded comics, and we became friends, and we've known each other ever since.
Oh, that's amazing. And it was fun staying home when you were sick.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Your parents left you alone. I, of course, have the record in our elementary school, junior high school, and high school as being the guy who hardly ever missed school.
Uh-huh.
They gave me an award for that. I think I may have missed one class.
Wow.
from first grade all the way through high school. And, you know, I'm the same way on the air here. You know, some talk show hosts will stub their toe and, you know, they won't be on for a couple days. I've missed 2 days in 13 years.
Wow.
Now.
Because wow.
I couldn't talk. I couldn't swallow.
Well, it's dedication, George, and I think people recognize your authenticity and your genuine quality, and I think that's why you've succeeded. And I think, you and I became fast friends from when we first met because, you know, we recognized kindred spirits.
Yes, absolutely. So now back to Space Command for a second. And there's just so many exciting things I want to talk with you about.
Sure.
My gosh, and we're going to open up the phone lines next hour. But you were able to develop this on a purse string compared to what Hollywood spends, right?
Yes, exactly. That's part of the reason why I did it this way. Just to put it in perspective, an hour of network television costs around anywhere from $2 million per hour up to $8 to $12 million per hour for a show like Game of Thrones. And that's a large amount of money. But I knew that with digital cameras and editing on a Mac and the Internet and so forth, that I could do things very, very differently. And so we did a Kickstarter campaign that we were able to raise $221,000 from the fan base, from 3,000 fans around the world. And then some of those fans then bought investment shares, which weren't very expensive. And we sold investment shares in the first film, and now we're selling them in the second film. And the fans are coming through. And what would have cost millions costs thousands for us to do it. And we're working with people around the world. Some of our visual effects artists are here. Some are in Spain. Some are in Germany. And when we were shooting just the last week on the second film, we had people from Holland working with us, people from Italy. There was someone who showed up who was from Inner Mongolia. And so the world is helping us make Space Command. And also, in terms of the actors I'm casting, I want the actors in Space Command to reflect the world that we live in. So, for instance, Mira Furlan is from former Yugoslavia, and I cast an actress playing her daughter from that part of the world. So when they're speaking to each other, they're speaking Serbo-Croatian. When they speak to other people, they speak English, and they're in outer space. And I just cast an actor named Ferran Tahir, who plays the first Federation captain in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movie. He gets speared in the chest by a Romulan, and he's also an Iron Man. He's in Elysium. But he's from Pakistan. And I think particularly now, with all that's going on in the world, to have all of us coming together to create something hopeful from all over the world, from the Middle East, from Asia, from Europe, from here, speaks to the unity of mankind in a way that's really walking the walk. And I think it's really important to put out messages of compassion and humanity in these very difficult times.
What is the concept behind Space Command?
The concept behind Space Command is that we have three families. One is a military family. They're captains in Space Command over several generations. There's one family that's a scientific family. That's Mira Furlan's family. She's an archaeologist. And there's a third family that ultimately, they start blue collar, but then they rise to a political leadership position over the generations. And then the staging ground for the series is Earth, Mars, the asteroid belt, the outer planets, and then finally the stars. And ultimately we encounter, and we have also what are called synthetic humans. They're replicants, androids. Doug Jones plays one of those. And then ultimately we do encounter alien races, but they're extremely alien. They're not humans. They're not just like in Star Trek, they have aliens where they have a little bump on the nose. It's something extremely inhuman in what we're creating, and really, really fun.
How long does it take you to shoot episodes?
Well, the first film took us 15 days to shoot, the two-hour story. The second film, we just shot, as I said, one-third of it. That's about 30 to 40 pages. We shot that over 6 days and over two three-day weekends.
High definition?
Yeah, we're shooting what's called 4K, which is even way beyond high definition. It's an extremely high-end visual format. We shoot on what are called red cameras, which are very high-end cameras.
Does it look like 35 millimeter?
It looks really good.
Yeah. It's close, isn't it?
Yeah. The images are just stunning, just gorgeous. And again, you mentioned the trailer. When one looks at the trailer, one sees exactly what we have in mind for the entire film. And we're just thrilled at what we're getting. There's a lot of special effects. There's a lot of everything. It's all the things that I love is in terms of great science fiction. It's funny because J.J. Abrams has been very encouraging. He and I are on very friendly terms, and so we've been emailing back and forth. He's been very encouraging about Space Command, as have Damon Lindelof and Guillermo del Toro, a lot of the people that I know well. And it's nice that they are able to see that they're not hindered by the fact that I'm not on the network. They see that this is quality work, and they recognize.
Well, and you've worked for many, many big networks.
Yes, I have.
Put out some great scripts, Mark, and this is time for you to shine, I
think.
And that would be just exciting as all get up. It really would. What's going on in Hollywood these days? I mean, when you look at television, it's got a zillion channels.
I know.
It's got everything. You know, I'm on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens. We're going to tape another year when I come back from the holidays here. I'm in St. Louis right now. But I mean, you know, Discovery Channel, History Channel, you know, Turner Network Television, CNN, Fox, HBO has a zillion channels. What is it too much?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It is, you know, they always talked about, when you and I were growing up, there were three networks, basically.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe PBS. And now there's this infinity. And you have Netflix, and you have Amazon. There's a show on Amazon called The Man in the High Castle, which is based on a very, very wonderful novel by Philip K. Dick. It's a great show. But one has to work much harder to find shows. There's at last count, there were over 400 scripted comedies and drama series. And that's a huge number. There's greater opportunity, but also it's a very cluttered field. So one has to work to find the shows that one loves. There's certain breakthrough shows like Game of Thrones, but I think it's going to get to a point in the future where you'll have shows that aren't even on networks, where you just say, well, I want to order Game of Thrones, and you order it like you'd order a book or you'd order music, you know, and it'll just be, you know, downloaded to your television or computer or phone. And I think that's the coming thing. And so, you know, a few years from now, if someone wants to order Space Command, they'll just go directly to whatever, you know, whatever ordering platform I'm on. And but now one does need a network or a big internet platform to promote, to put in the promotional money so that it's on buses, it's on billboards, people are aware of it, because it just takes that much promotion to punch through all the clutter and all the noise.
What is your favorite Twilight Zone episode?
Well, there's a lot of great episodes, George. I think, you know, there's one that was Sterling's favorite. It's called Walking Distance, and it's about a man who goes back into his own past, the past of his childhood. He's a very beleaguered executive, and it's beautifully written and beautifully performed piece. It's terrific, very nostalgic, similar to Stop at Willoughby. Of course, Eye of the Beholder with the woman's head wrapped in bandages. That's an amazing episode. There's so many of them.
There's so many. You really can't single them out.
Yeah.
And he developed some great programs for emerging actors, did he not?
Well, yes, my God. I mean, actors like Robert Redford or Lee Marvin. Anne Francis is terrific in The Twilight Zone, in The After Hours, where she plays, you know, a woman who ultimately becomes a mannequin. It's funny, I found some color photos that I'm going to be reproducing in the new Twilight Zone ebook, companion ebook, and there's several color photos from that episode and from Eye of the Beholder that have never been published. It's amazing stuff, and I love, week after week, he was getting the top actors in Hollywood, and I talked to many of them, because some of them weren't doing television, some of the big-name stars, and they said, but it'd be a Rod Serling script, and you'd get it, and how could you turn it down? It was so phenomenal.
You know, you brought Rod's wife, Carol, to the program, his daughter, Anne, of course. They've written books. They miss him. They miss him a lot.
Yeah, of course. He was such a strong personality and such a loving man. You know, the funny thing is there are certain people that you see them on TV and you just get a sense of who they are, and you get a sense of what great people they would be to know. And Rod was that way. He was funny. He was just very personable, but very warm. And Burgess Meredith told me something that really stuck with me when I interviewed him for The Twilight Zone Companion. He said, like many great writers, Rod listened a good deal more than he talked. And so he was fascinated by people. And I heard this all over and over, where he would meet someone, and it wouldn't be Rod gaining, you know, standing in the spotlight. It would be him wanting to know about you. And he was just a terrific guy in that way.
You know, Mark, since this has been going on, since you've been listening to The Twilight Zone as a kid, since I've been, and, you know, you started writing these programs, The Twilight Zone Companion, your book, and you've got another one coming, has been just a great part of what The Twilight Zone is. It truly is the companion.
Yeah. Well, I was very gratified. Back in 2006, the New York Times listed 10 science fiction books for the ages, and mine was the only nonfiction book on that list. And it was funny because Ray Bradbury was on that list too, and it was great fun to bring that copy of the New York Times to Ray's house and say, look, we're on the same list together. And just a real high point. And, you know, it's funny, for many years, my publisher, Silman James, has been after me to do an ebook of the Twilight Zone Companion, and I finally decided to do it because I could have links to audio and video and have color photographs, and many the new edition will be has over 70 pages of new material. It's got scripts, it's got all sorts of rarities. In fact, the entire audio of my interviews with Burgess Meredith and Ross Martin will be on it. There'll be Rod Serling commercials, you name it, just tons of things that I've never been able to include before, because finally the technology caught up where we can have these links to these amazing, amazing rarities. When I first wrote the book, you'd have to go to universities all over the country and put these 35-millimeter prints or 16-millimeter prints on a moviola and watch them. You know, now you can click on the internet or click on a link to a site, and there it is. So that was one of the strong reasons why I wanted to do it. And also another reason was because after I wrote the book, many of the people I interviewed told me further stories that weren't in the book. For instance, Douglas Hayes, who directed Eye of the Beholder, the one with the woman whose head is wrapped in bandages, she's in the hospital waiting to find out if she's been made to look normal. Doug told me that when he was directing that episode, he realized they were going to run short, and Rod was out of town, and so Doug wrote a scene in that episode that's not credited to him. And finally, when he screened it for Rod, he was just, you know, on pins and needles, and Rod looked at the scene and said, "Good job, good scene," and Doug let out a sigh of relief. So that wasn't in the book originally, but it's going to be in the new edition.
Well, the Twilight Zone was called an anthology.
Yes,
they're not doing that much anymore, are they?
Not much. They're very hard to sell, and every few years you'll get something like Tales of the Crypt or something like that. But they're a very difficult sell because week to week to week they're different. It's not like Breaking Bad, where every week you would have the same characters, or Mad Men, or any of those shows.
People like that. They like these same characters.
Yeah.
They get attached to them.
Yeah, but every now and then an anthology show does break through, but it's very hard to maintain quality. I mean, Rod really was one of a kind.
Well, and he was the star of the show.
Yes, he was. And the funny thing was, they never intended for him to be the host. Originally, when they shot the pilot, they had a guy named Westbrook von Voorhees, who had been the voice of the March of Time, and he had this big stentorian voice, totally wrong for Twilight Zone. Then they were thinking of Orson Welles, but he wanted too much money. Finally, they were running out of options, and Rod said, "Well, how about me?" And the last acting he'd done was in high school drama club, and they fell out of their chairs laughing, but then they tried it, and of course he was the perfect choice.
Was it an instant success?
It did very well critically, and it was sort of a good ratings success, but not a huge top 10 show. But it won it won Emmys for best series 2 years running, 1959 and 1960, and so it people realized that it was really something new on the horizon and quite wonderful.
What do emerging writers try to do now these days in Hollywood, and actors too?
Well, you know, the ones who really succeed and do something worth doing are looking to create something authentic, something genuine, something fresh, something truthful, something that comments on the world. You know, I as you mentioned earlier, I mentor literally thousands of writers and directors and actors and producers, young people starting out, and I always say, don't just do what everyone else is doing. Find your truth. Ray Bradbury, who mentored me, said, look inward. Don't look outward. Look inward for your truth, and I strongly believe that.
Mark, we're going to come up to the top of the hour. We'll take phone calls next hour with you about the Twilight Zone and the Space Command and just what's going on in Hollywood these days. Is the big money still following some big films?
Yes. I mean, I think everyone's waiting for Star Wars to come out next week. I think that's going to
be huge.
Yeah, but you know, again, you know, for all of us who are in this game for the right reasons, you know, and as you know, I know a lot of the top people in the industry. The money, it's very nice to be paid very well, but that's not why we're really doing it. We're doing it because the idea of creating something from our heart that we can share with the world that lasts. I mean, there are things I wrote in my early 20s that people are still watching and enjoying, and people are still reading The Twilight Zone Companion. I hear about that every week, and it's very meaningful to write something that moves other people and that they find of value.
Let's come back in a moment. Let's talk about The Twilight Zone and some things in Hollywood. Check in with us. The lines are open on Coast to Coast AM.